Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. If history were an Olympic event, it would likely be categorized as an individual sport. Over the centuries, many of the best-known works of history have been produced by individual authors. But in 1977, Latter-day Saint historian Leonard J. Arrington wrote a personal essay in which he promoted the idea of historians working in teams. Dr. Arrington, whose PhD was in economics, titled his essay, Historian as Entrepreneur. And his essay exudes his sense that tackling the most difficult historical topics and projects would require teamwork. So building on this concept, over the last four decades, historian and other scholarly professionals of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have successfully used this team approach to tackle projects that might otherwise have proved impossible because of their scale or complexity. And Richard E. Turley Jr. is giving the Arrington Mormon History Lecture. It happens every year at Utah State University. It's this evening, 7 o'clock, Russell Wanless Performance Hall on the USU Logan campus. And he's going to take Dr. Arrington's theme and talk about achievements of the church's professional staff for the last four decades in fulfilling Dr. Arrington's vision of team history. Richard E. Turley Jr. is former managing director of the Church History and Family History Departments of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, where he helped envision, launch, and lead many of the church's most important historical projects of the last four decades. He's authored or edited more than 20 books on Latter-day Saint and Western United States history. So it's a pleasure to welcome you back to the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
In studio this time, which is nice, right?
It is.
Good to have you back in Logan. I've been reading a little bit of this this essay from Dr. Arrington. This is from the 70s, right?
Yes.
By that time, well-established as a historian and had become a church historian. I just want to quote from this. He says he got a grant from USU to produce some projects during the summertime, during which he'd have help, right? This idea of teamwork. And he says, this began broadening my career. Henceforth, I would not only be an individual scholar, but a historical entrepreneur, organizing large projects and team efforts. Later in the essay, he says, for one of his projects over one of the summers, he was able to have two accounting majors and a couple of other assistants to help him. This was some economic history. So I guess this was the approach that the Church History Department formally embraced, I guess?
We did embrace that, and for a good reason. If you think about most histories that are written, they are often written by a single author, and that's because historians typically go through a graduate school program that requires a thesis or a dissertation or both. And in the process of developing that, they're doing it on their own. And so when they get into the realm of becoming a public historian or an academic historian, they're used to that pattern. And if you look at a lot of the best-known books that have ended up on college syllabuses or else have won awards, they're often written by just a single author. And we decided that if you think about what a single author can do, let's assume that you're an academic historian and you could devote as much as 1,000 hours a year to a project. Now, I've talked to a lot of academic historians who said there's no way I can give 1,000 hours. But let's suppose that you're optimistic and you can do that because you have some funding that allows that. If you worked for 10 years, you could put in 10,000 hours on a book or some other kind of project. So a long time ago, we asked the question, well, what if you put in 20,000 hours or 50,000 hours or 100,000 hours or 200,000 hours? What could you do? And we imagined you could do things that lone historians could not do by themselves. And so we put together teams and worked on projects that would have been simply impossible for a single scholar to produce.
That must have been quite the experience for you. You're, I guess, the entrepreneur you're putting these teams together, leading them, right?
I am. I come from a science family. My father was a professor of engineering at the University of Utah. He was Utah's first science advisor, so I grew up in an environment of science. And my father also was an early adopter of technology, and he taught a course at the University of Utah on entrepreneurship, and he kind of infected me with that. And I've always been an out-of-the-box thinker, so innovation is natural for me. So I liked applying these new techniques.
So the advantages are clear, right? Scale, right?
Yes.
You can do so much more research, so much more, produce so many more volumes of history. I'm thinking maybe one disadvantage I could think of is you're losing maybe a single distinctive voice, right? If I think about some of my favorite, Barbara Tuchman, for example, love her works. I expect some asides from her and I get her voice and her interpretation. And I know it's hers, right? Is that a concern of yours? You lose that, perhaps?
It can be an issue, and so it's something that you have to manage along with all the other aspects of the project. For example, when two others and I, along with a big team, created the volume Massacre at Mountain Meadows, published by Oxford University Press in 2008, we were concerned that using a team, we might end up with a disjointed narrative. And so we worked our process so that we ended up with a single voice. I don't think people can tell by reading which chapters were initially prepared by which person. And when we produced the sequel to that work, Vengeance is Mine, again, Oxford, this time 2023, we also ended up with a single voice, even though there were two authors and a team of people helping. So that is a real concern. It's one you just have to manage along with all the other aspects of the project.
Let's talk about kind of the far side of this. So Saints, this is a volume the church produced of four volumes.
Yes.
Of the church's history. Again, teams of researchers, right?
There were many people who worked on that. In fact, the first volume went through the hands of 900 people before it was finally produced.
Wow.
We intended this to go to a broad audience, mostly of Latter-day Saints, across the world. And so we had it vetted by people in various countries around the world to make sure it was understandable. Sometimes when you write from a particular cultural standpoint, in our case, most of our writers were in the United States of America. When you do that, then you tacitly have a lot of assumptions, some of which are culturally based, and you need to vet those with people in other areas who might not share the same assumptions.
Yeah. Then I'm sure you had people actually writing the narrative, and
yes.
you took great care. We were talking before we went on the air. Tell me a little bit about that. You're targeting a specific audience, specific reading level, right?
Yes. So when we first got the permission from our church leaders to write a multi-volume history and the resources to do it, we sat down and I talked to our team. Because I'm an innovator and a visual thinker, I often use a whiteboard. So I stood up the whiteboard and I drew a Venn diagram of three interlocking circles. And in the upper left diagram, I wrote the initial H. And in the circle to the right, I wrote L. And then in the bottom circle, I wrote A. And I explained that H stands for history, and we wanted to make certain that the history we were promoting was historically accurate, so we would begin with professional historians who would outline what should be in each volume and would draft the initial chapters. But if the historians wrote it, I concluded from my experience, they would probably aim it at the audience they're most used to addressing, which is their own peers. And I felt that if we were going to address a broad worldwide audience, it would be difficult for the worldwide audience to understand what they had written. So L in the next circle stood for literarily compelling. And we decided that we would take what the historians had written and hand it to creative writers from good writing programs who knew how to address writing to a broad general audience. Then we would take what they had written and take it down to the lower circle, A, wash it through some software, and make sure that it was aimed at a ninth grade reading audience, because to hit a global audience, we had to hit about that level. We concluded that with a ninth grade reading audience level, we could hit over 90% of the people that we wanted to read it. By the time it made that first spiral from H to L to A, distortions would be introduced, just because when you have many hands working on something, if there are people along the way who don't know the history, they're going to make assumptions that are not correct and they'll introduce errors. So we then were going to take what was produced to that point, hand it back to the historians, have them correct it, pass it to the literary people again, and go in an ever-tightening circle until we got into that sweet spot in which the text was historically accurate, literarily compelling, and fit our ninth grade reading audience. That was a chore, but we got it done.
That's a very interesting process. So you actually used software to get it at the ninth grade level?
Yes, at least initially.
Yeah. And then you got to do these iterations
to
get rid of the distortions. It's an interesting process. Do you ever get pushback from professional historians saying this is just, you're taking this too far to... to go to a, you know, a broad audience?
You know, I really haven't gotten pushback. I think that if you look at the way historians typically approach the world, usually as, again, if we were analogizing this to sports, it would be a solo sport in many cases, or as, you know, solo sports like gymnastics, figure skating, and so forth. Sometimes you have people who work in pairs. You know, you might have pairs diving. You might have, you know, pairs figure skating and so forth. But they rarely broaden it beyond that range. That's actually a very good way to deal with certain topics. But when you get to really complicated topics or advanced topics, you need more. And the analogy that I would give is to other areas of learning, other disciplines. So if you look at the six categories of the Nobel Prize, there's, if I can remember them, physics, chemistry, economic science, physiology or medicine, the Peace Prize, and then literature. And if you look at those and see who gets awarded a Nobel Prize each year, for many of those categories, it's a team of people, two or three. Whereas for literature, it's often just a single person. Now, there's no Nobel Prize for history, but I would suggest that the model for writing history in the past has been like the model for producing literature, often just a solo kind of author. And there's a reason that subjects like medicine use teams, and it's because the discipline is advanced to the point at which if you're going to tackle very, very difficult topics, they require a wide range of talent, a lot of resources. And so what we've tried to do, what Leonard Arrington tried to do, as he mentions in his Historian as Entrepreneur essay, is to apply that same type of model.
Now, are there different purposes for different projects? For example, you worked for the church, right? Church,
yes,
of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It is a church. So there are purposes there. So one of the purposes could be promoting faith among members, right?
So when you write anything, when you produce any type of product for an audience, your eyes are on that audience. So the projects that we produced during the time that I was there covered a range of audiences. The Joseph Smith Papers, for example, a very large and complicated project that took a lot of work from a lot of people. We specifically aimed that at an academic audience. Now, we ended up with a secondary audience of Latter-day Saints who were interested enough in it that they bought the volume or looked at it online. So we know we had a large non-academic audience, but our initial aim was the academic audience. We wanted these volumes to be presentable to an academic audience that would evaluate them and consider that we had used the best economic techniques to create what we did. And we succeeded at that. For Saints, we intended that four-volume set to be for members of our church. And so we couched it in that way. That's the tone that we adopted. So audience drives the way you do the project.
Let's talk about the Joe Smith Papers. Massive project.
Yes.
Years and years. Frankly, money needed, right? So Larry Miller, right?
Yeah, so when we were first envisioning the project, we concluded that we needed three things. We needed the resources in terms of historical information. We needed access to Joseph Smith's papers. The majority of his papers were at church headquarters, where I was in charge of the historical department. And so we had those. Then we needed to negotiate with other institutions that had some of his papers. So we felt like we could get past that obstacle of getting access to the papers. Second, we needed talent. We particularly needed Joseph Smith experts. And many of those were at BYU, Brigham Young University, including Dean Jesse, who was at the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute, which was the name of the entity that left church headquarters in 1982 and went down to BYU with Leonard Arrington as its head. So we needed the people in that division to combine with the people at church headquarters and the resources there. Then on top of all that, we needed some financing. These types of projects are never inexpensive. You need to employ people. They want to be paid. That's understandable. All of us do who are professionals. And then you also needed money for travel, and you needed money for other types of expenses. And fortunately, Larry Miller and his wife, Gail Miller, and their family came in and provided extraordinary funding to make that possible. So when we had the historical resources, the papers, and the people, and the finances, then we could put it together.
That puts me in mind, maybe have you talk a little bit about this, the attitudes, the opinions of the top church leaders have a great effect, obviously. So the hiring of Leonard Arrington, putting together that team, was seen as an opening, period of opening, right? And then he was released and went down to BYU, and that was seen as a kind of a period of more, retracting. And then later on, you were involved in a period of what's seen as a pretty open period.
Yeah, so I think institutions like people go through periods of maturity, and I think we've reached a period of real maturity in which we follow professional practices, we use principles to guide what we do. And so I think that the things that we produce and the people that we hire are really quite good. In fact, after I got there and had the opportunity to begin hiring people, we were very careful in choosing people who had the skills that were necessary. When I first arrived, many of the employees of the department were people who did not have training in a technical field. They weren't professionally trained historians or archivists or librarians or curators and so forth. Some were. Some really good people were there, but some of them were not. So what we did as people retired is we replaced the people who didn't have the training with people who did have the training, so that today the organization as a whole is more professionally trained and polished than were people in Leonard's day.
Hmm. Now, the Joe Smith papers, you're trying to be as transparent as you can. In fact, you published the actual documents, right?
Yes.
From which this history is taken. I guess more and more of these documents over the years become available, right? You went searching for as many as you could, right?
Yeah, so our goal with the Joseph Smith papers was to make available all of the Joseph Smith papers that we could. That meant all of them in our possession, as well as all that we could get from other institutions and private collectors. And we did a pretty good job of that. And also our goal was to put people in direct contact with the documents. Yes, we provided introductions. Yes, we provided footnotes and other commentary in order to help guide people, particularly when they were dealing with vocabulary or subjects that they didn't know about. But our goal was to get out from between the materials and the people, let them read those things themselves and come up with their own conclusions.
Mm-hmm. One more thing before we go to break. In terms of audiences. Professional historians, at least in the past, have, we were talking before we went on the air, you mentioned this, tend to write for each other.
Yes.
To each other, right?
Yes.
Which can seem a bit of a waste. I mean, it's I'm not a professional historian. I want to read some history, right? And if I'm reading something that's just for another academic, it can tend to be dry. Sometimes just by accident, the person's a good writer. But I tend to gravitate toward those who are writing to me,
yes.
Right?
So it's true that historians, because of the academic process through which they went in order to become historians, tend to write to their own peers. They write for peer-reviewed publications, and they write books that are often an outgrowth of their dissertations and then follow on the subject matter that became their area of expertise. Much of what historians say, unfortunately, never makes it to the broader audience. And I am a personal proponent of the idea that historians write more broadly so that the good information on which they spend their careers can be enjoyed by a much broader range of people.
I think that's very true. I suppose, you know, work is not wasted, right? Academic historians will do that research, and then maybe a popular historian will come and base their work on that research and write in such a way that I can read it, right?
That's always the hope. And in fact, when we created the Joseph Smith Papers Project, we did that with the hope that it would become the foundation for other people who could write about Joseph Smith and the era in which he lived.
Now, there's always a contest over history, right? You do the best you can, go to the sources. Interpretation as well, but there's a contest over interpretation.
So history that is about people will always be contested because people are human and humans make mistakes and people have various ideas about how you interpret what people did. Historians essentially do three things. They do research to gather information. Second, they take that information and they interpret it. If you want to analogize it to a jigsaw puzzle, So suppose they have this 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle and they find 18 pieces of the puzzle. They then lay those pieces out on the table and try to envision what the puzzle looked like. Now, using those same 18 pieces, people, reasonable minds, could differ in terms of what that original picture was. Contrary to popular belief, historians usually cannot recover the entire past. They can only work with pieces of the past and then try to interpret how the past was. And then the third thing that historians do is they take that interpretation and they communicate it to others through books, articles, and other media.
Now, you were saying that in the future, you know, people seeking bigger and better audiences, the media might be different, might not be books.
Yes, so book reading will always be there, but more and more, particularly rising generations of people, consume most of their information in some type of video format, and who knows what the future will bring. I think 20 years ago, most of us could not conceive what we have today, and certainly in the 1970s, the first personal computer was really marketed in 1977. So in terms of the digital age in which we live, that's about a half century old, and those of us who are older than that, as I am, can remember it's the time pre-digital when we did everything with paper. Today's generations can't imagine living without digital media, and there are, because I'm a lover of technology and was raised by a scientific father, I tend to look forward at technology and see what's on the horizon, and the technologies I see on the horizon are going to be mind-blowing by our current perceptions today. And I think that new technologies being developed right now and developed in the future will be some of the mechanisms by which we communicate historical interpretations.
And in this new media, I guess you always have the problem of what's the purpose of this creator of this media, right? So if it's a documentary and they're trying to adhere to the facts, that's one thing. If it's a more popular movie, then they have a different agenda.
So every person who writes brings a point of view to their writing. That same is true of people who are producing something. And so one of the questions you need to ask is, what is the purpose for which these people are producing what they're producing? So let's take historical movies, for example. Historical movies are notoriously inaccurate from the viewpoint of professional historians. But the purpose of the people who produce the movies may be entertainment. And so movie producers rarely come from the historical profession. And so they come from a profession that's geared towards entertaining an audience. And to them, if they use a few historical elements and then call their film based on a true story, that's good enough. What the consumer needs to realize is that if a movie is based on a true story, it may not be based on a lot of the true story. And therefore, if they really are interested, if they're interested in watching a movie purely for entertainment, that's one thing. But if they want to judge the past, what happened in the past, on the basis of a movie, they ought to supplement their film watching with reading some books.
Hmm. Well, let's take a break. We'll come back much more with Richard Turley, who is giving the Arrington Mormon History Lecture. It happens every year about this time. And Richard Turley is giving a lecture called Team History, the Latter-day Saint Historical Enterprise, 1986 to 2025. That is happening this evening, 7 o'clock, Russell Wanless Performance Hall on the USU campus in Logan. We'll have more on the program following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Richard E. Turley, Jr. He is former managing director of the Church History and Family History Departments of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he's giving the Arrington Mormon History Lecture called, his lecture is titled Team History, Latter-day Saint Historical Enterprise, 1986 to 2025. That's happening this evening at 7 o'clock in the Russell Wanless Performance Hall on the USU campus in Logan. Everyone's invited to that. So, Richard Turley, I want to go back and get a little bit of your history. You understand you, got an interest in history, and specifically history of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in your teenage years.
That's correct. So as a child, I was very curious about a lot of things. I was curious about science and literature and, you know, a whole wide range of topics. I have friends who knew from the time they were quite small that they wanted to enter into a particular profession. I did not know what I wanted to do because everything that I studied was interesting to me. When I was 15, I was involved in an event that got me diving deeply into Latter-day Saint church history, and I found it fascinating. And so I continued to nurture that interest through my undergraduate and graduate school days. In order to graduate from Brigham Young University with highest honors, you had to complete what was called a university scholar project. It was meant to be essentially a master's thesis or master's project equivalent. And so I completed mine under the direction of James B. Allen, who was the chairman of the history department and a former assistant church historian under Leonard Arrington. Then when I went to law school, which was my choice of careers, and I'll pause for a moment to explain how I chose that career. I was up early one morning with my father having breakfast. I came from a family of seven children spaced a year apart, and so individual time with a parent was not that common. Here we were alone, and he asked me the question that parents have been asking children for generations. He said, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" And I said, "Dad, I really don't know. I love every subject in school. I do well in every subject in school. It's hard for me to choose." And at that point, he was the state science advisor, and he said, "You know, I'm often up on Capitol Hill advising the governor and the legislature, and I run into people from all walks of life, and I noticed a commonality. A lot of these people started off life as lawyers, and then they bridged to something else. So if you don't know what you want to do with your life, why don't you go into law?" And I essentially said, "Done." So I chose law not because it was a particular interest, but because it seemed to be a practical interest. And along the way, I nurtured a lot of my other interests, including history, doing as much as I could to study it and become interested in it. Then when I had an opportunity, when I was invited by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to join their church historical department, as it was then called, I jumped at the opportunity.
Pretty surprising, I would imagine. You're a young lawyer. And you get a call from, I don't know who in the church.
So I got a telephone call from Dallin H. Oaks, a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles, one of the leading members of our church's leadership. And he invited me to lunch, and we talked. And then later on, he invited me to see some other people. And then after that, they offered me this position. And I want you to put yourself in my place. Okay, imagine that you're in your late 20s, which is what I was. You're deeply interested in this type of history. And someone offers you a job in which they give you all the keys and combinations and say you're in charge. That's a pretty tantalizing offer. And it was one that I thought I wanted to take.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't a professional historian, right?
I was not.
Was there any pushback from staff or anybody in the department?
There was. In fact, on one occasion, I had a number of staff members come into my office, sit down, and essentially say to me, "You don't belong here. You don't have the requisite education. You don't have the requisite background, like many of us who spent years here." And they went down through a list of requests that they, or list of issues that they had with my being there. And I listened carefully to what they had to say. And when they finished, I said, "You're right. Every statement that you've made is valid. But I was invited to be here, and I accepted this responsibility, and I'm going to fulfill this responsibility, but I won't be able to do it without the help of all of you. Hence, I needed a team."
Right.
And so those people who came into me and made those statements became some of the top leaders in our organization. I recognized them as having leadership skill and also professional skill in their areas. And so we built teams with these people that then allowed us to be successful. Mm.
At that time, were you aware of Dr. Arrington's, paper on team, historian as entrepreneur?
I don't know when I read that. I was familiar with Dr. Arrington. I met him almost the moment I walked into the door. Mm-hmm. He was very kind and friendly and gentle. I interviewed him for my first book on the Mark Hoffman case. I found him an inspiration. And so somewhere along the line, I read that article and I was persuaded by it.
Mm-hmm. By the way, back at age 15 and going forward, what kinds of things did you read?
At that age, I started off by reading journal articles, and then I began to read books. So I remember one of the first questions that Leonard Arrington asked me when I met him. I complimented him on Brigham Young American Moses, which he had published not long before that. And he asked me what I thought of it, and I told him I liked it, and I hoped that it would be the first of many volumes on Brigham Young that he might write that would go into even further detail than what he had written. So I never felt as though I was somehow constrained in my education by what I was taught by my professors or even in my church setting. I felt that as an individual, I had the responsibility to go out and do research on my own, and I did. I read widely.
Hmm. What lessons do you think are the top lessons from this is quite a sweep of time that you were in that department?
So one of the lessons I learned is the importance of teams. And with teams, you have individuals who may differ in their points of view. I mentioned that historians gather information. With teams, we could gather vastly more information than we could as, you know, lone scholars. Well, I remember for our book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows and the sequel, Vengeance is Mine, we did research, I think, in 33 different states plus 3 different National Archives facilities. That would have been very, very difficult. The second thing I learned is that because reasonable minds can differ in their interpretation, it's important to bring in a wide range of people and vet your ideas with those people. With my first book, which I submitted to University of Illinois Press for publication, the normal process would have been to submit it to the press, and the press would normally have 3 peer reviewers go over it and then make suggestions. I decided very consciously that before I submitted it to the press, I would submit it to 24 people from a wide range of backgrounds so that I could get their feedback and incorporate it before it went to the peer review. My idea was always, let's figure out the problems and resolve them before they're published instead of hear them in reviews after a work is published.
Yeah, they're very, very smart, yeah. Was that first book, the one on Mark Hoffman?
Yes, it's called Victims, the LDS Church, yeah, and the Mark Hoffman Case.
So that was very early on. You were tell me about how that came about.
Well, it came about in a very interesting way. I landed at the Church Historical Department a few months after the Mark Hoffman bombings in Salt Lake City that killed 2 people and actually injured Mark Hoffman himself. So when I landed at the Church Historical Department, in many ways, I landed in a crime scene. There were investigators who were looking around trying to figure out a motive for Mark Hoffman's murders. We were working with them and presenting documents and other things to them, and they ultimately determined that he was a forger. And so being there, I'd never met him, but being there in the wake of all of that, it was kind of like a fly on the wall during the investigation. And as I saw various publications come out about the case, I thought, well, I've got a story I can tell. And so I proposed that. So one of the rules that I followed in the work that I did at church headquarters is I wanted to make sure there were no surprises. I always made the people above me aware of what I wanted to do and got their clearance in advance so that it wouldn't be an issue later on. So I went to them and said I wanted to do this, and at the same time, they came to me and said they wanted me to do it. Mm. And I thought that it was either my idea that they then were confirming, and they thought it was their idea that I was then confirming. So it was sort of one of those situations in which you have independent origin. Mm-hmm. Either way, I wanted to do it with some provisos, recognizing that some of the church leaders were characters in this book. They would have to be. As a proviso of my preparing this book, I requested that they give me everything that they had, their journals, their calendars, everything that they had. Second, I required that I be the author of the book and that they not control what the content would be. Now, those are somewhat breathtaking requests, but they agreed to those in advance. And so having agreed to that, they stuck to their word, and I was able to publish it with those provisos.
For people who, a lot of us will remember Mark Hoffman, people who don't, catch us up a little bit. The documents that he had, were verified by experts, right? And then appeared they were real. Later on, determined forgeries.
So the document that he discovered that got the first really big news coverage was a document that he produced while he was a student here at Utah State University. He forged a document that was meant to look like a document that Joseph Smith had produced early on in his translation of the Book of Mormon. And it was called the Anthon Transcript. And he took that document, folded it, and put it into a Bible, which he claimed he got from a Joseph Smith family descendant. Then he brought the Bible to Utah State University campus, talked to an archivist here. The archivist helped him open the page that was stuck down. And when they opened it, the archivist saw it and immediately presumed that it was this long-lost document, and that sort of catapulted Mark Hoffman to fame. That item was acquired by the church, and so from 1980, when he first produced it, until 1985, when the bombs were there, the church and many other people, many other organizations and people acquired his documents. Ultimately, he was trying to sell the what he claimed to be the first printed document in America, the Oath of a Freeman, and he went to the Library of Congress and then to another, you know, well-known collecting institution in an effort to sell that. He was not able to sell that. He wanted to sell it because he'd gotten himself into real financial difficulties by overspending. He wasn't very good at financial management, so he would spend money before he produced it through creating forgeries and selling the documents. Ultimately, to try to cover up his trail, he planted bombs that killed people, and he was trying to send police off his tail in another direction. But the investigators were able to determine that his documents were forged, and that was his motive for murder, and he's now in prison.
So apart from financial gain, what were his motives?
In addition to financial gain, he had a couple of other motives. One of his motives was that he loved to push against authority of any kind, and he felt that by forging documents that related to Latter-day Saint history, to United States history, even to, you know, literature that was more broad than that, he was pushing against the experts or to the authority figures, in the case of the church, you know, church leaders. He also had a desire to alter history. He wanted to be the chief interpreter of history, and he would use his documents to set people down interpretive paths, which in many cases people followed, and some people are still following those interpretive paths today.
I guess as a layman, I would wonder, well, he fooled the experts, right? So that's troubling.
It's troubling. In interviewing some of the investigators, I asked the question, was Mark Hoffman the best forger in history? Now, I didn't believe he was, but I asked that question just to see what their response would be. And one of the county investigators said, no, the best forger has never been caught. And what that helps all of us to understand is that in the process of doing historical research, we have to start at the beginning by asking the question, is this document or other piece of evidence real? Was it created at the time and place that it purports, or is there something about it that's fishy? And so that's something that oftentimes people just skip right over. They just assume it's going to be accurate, but it's a question we need to ask.
Yeah. Let's take another break. We'll come back with more with Richard Turley. He is giving the Errington Mormon History Lecture. It's called Team History, Latter-day Saint Historical Enterprise, 1986 to 2025. This evening, 7 o'clock, Russell Wandless Performance Hall on the USU Logan campus. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're in our final segment now of Access Utah for today. We're talking with Richard E. Turley, Jr. He is former managing director of the Church History and Family History Departments of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And he's giving the Errington Mormon History Lecture. That's this evening, 7 o'clock, Russell Wandless Performance Hall on the USU campus in Logan. It's called Team History, Latter-day Saint Historical Enterprise, 1986 to 2025. Everyone is welcome. So I've talked to you several times about your books on Mountain Meadows Massacre, but I wonder if you could remind us how you got involved in writing this history. And there's been a long history of how church members, well, non-members as well, and the church in itself dealt with this for decades. It was, let's bury this. Right. Let's pretend it never happened. Let's never speak of it. There's some pushback to Juanita Brooks when she went around trying to uncover it. Right.
Correct.
So what was your attitude going in? What did you want to accomplish?
I don't remember when I first became aware of the massacre, but certainly by the time I was around 20, I was aware of it. When I became the managing director of the church historical department, one of the things that bothered me in the wake of the Mark Hoffman bombings is that Hoffman's bombings and related types of things had convinced people that somehow or another history was dangerous. Now, I get that history can be controversial because it's about people, but I didn't think it was any more dangerous than literature or chemistry or, you know, other subjects. And so I wanted to do something that would attract people to history and help them realize it's not dangerous. So as I cast around in my mind, I thought of a subject. And to give you some background on that subject, after I became managing director, we began as a department to work with the descendants of victims of the massacre and descendants of the perpetrators who had encountered each other down at the Mount Meadows Massacre site. And we worked with them and as well as the state of Utah and the National Park Service and ended up erecting a monument in 1980 on a hill above the massacre site in which we listed the names as they were figured out by a team of people working together. And then in 1989, we erected another monument, again, working with descendants of the victims. And so I was very interested in this topic. And so I thought to myself, well, I know of no subject that's worse than the Mountain Meadows Massacre. What if we were to tackle that subject and just shine a light on it, get out all the information we possibly can about it? Then people don't need to be afraid. They can say, we can say you can look at the most difficult subject, shine light on it, and get understanding from it. As I often say to people, I and my co-author Barbara Jones Brown, no one alive today is responsible for the massacre, but we're all responsible for how we deal with it. So let's deal with it openly and honestly. Now that was a kind of breathtaking proposal at the time that I came up with this idea. Around 2000, that we were going to produce a book on the subject. I vetted it upline and got the permissions in advance, so I didn't have to deal with that after the fact. And we went forward, myself and two co-authors who were Ronald W. Walker, who had been a historian with Leonard Arrington, and then Glenn Leonard, who had also been a historian with him. He was, at that point, the director of the Church History Museum, or what was then called the Museum of Church History and Art. Three of us went forward, and we had a team of people. And we worked on this subject, and it was so complex, so complicated, that ultimately we decided after 7 years that if we were going to get something to press, we had to sort of cut the story in half. So we cut it in half, published the first volume in 2008, and then 15 years later, after we had published three more volumes that we sort of needed as a background for that, then we published Vengeance is Mine in 2023. And I think it's had an effect. I think people have recognized that you can take a topic like the Mountain Meadows Massacre and examine it in all of its horrible detail and get enlightenment from doing that. You can learn from the past. If you don't learn from the past, then you repeat the past in ways that are not very good.
Mm. I should back up and have you just maybe some of the audience who don't know what happened, just tell us in brief.
So in brief, the Mountain Meadows Massacre was the worst incident in Utah history. And I saw a website one time that said it was also the worst incident in the history of northwestern Arkansas because the victims were from there. Mm-hmm. And so in September of 1857, a company of immigrants on their way from the Midwest, mostly Arkansas, to California, were massacred by a group of southern Utah settlers under conditions that we describe in the book. And this type of horrific massacre occurring at short range, a massacre of men, women, and children, mostly women and children, deserves careful scrutiny, and we gave it that.
Hmm. What lessons do you draw from this history?
Well, one of the lessons that I draw from this history is that when people get excited, they ought to look themselves in the mirror and say, is there a way that I can de-escalate the situation? Can I calm down? Often these types of terrible events, massacres, mass killings occur in settings like war, periods of war when people get really, really excited, and then they jump to doing things that they would not have done in time of peace. And we say to people, rather than nurture conflict, let's nurture peace. Let's accept the challenge, the assignment to de-escalate rather than escalate situations. Having studied that topic for a long time, I've had nightmares about it, and I've actually been in the middle of my day And suddenly my mind drifts off and I feel that I'm at the Mountain Meadows and the massacre is about to happen. And I just want to run across the field, waving my arms, screaming, don't do it.
Mm. Yeah. That's interesting. You've immersed yourself so much in this research that mm-hmm. it has affected you. I know you've said that one lesson in tackling this history is we shouldn't avoid the dark parts of history, including in your family's history.
Yes, that's correct. And I will say this, that there is a, you know, I was over the church's family history department for a long period of time, and I learned that people are motivated to do their family history for a variety of reasons, one of which is often to bring glory to themselves, if I can say that candidly. People want to find out that they're descendant of someone in, who's a celebrity or a member of royalty or something like that, because they feel that that light shines on them in a positive sort of way. But the reality is, the more we study our family history, the more we will find things with which we're uncomfortable. And it's important for us to confront the truth of our family history, not just the good parts, but also confront the difficult parts. And once again, I will say, as I've said with the Mountain Meadows Massacre, we are not responsible for the behavior or attitudes of our ancestors, but we are responsible for how we deal with what we learn.
Another thing you've said is we should look at history in totality.
Yes, and often people see history only from a small, you know, vantage point. We're all familiar with the famous story of the men from Hindustan who encounter the elephant. You know, one sees the tail and thinks it's a rope. One sees the side and thinks it's a wall, and so on. One holds onto the tusk and thinks it's a spear, and one holds onto the, you know, there's a trunk and thinks it's a snake. You don't get the total picture unless you combine the views of all of these people. So when you're doing any type of history, including your family history, you need to look at a wide variety of sources and see if you can understand your ancestor or any type of historical person or setting from multiple perspectives so you can get the true picture. To use another analogy, if I were to set a piece of sculpture in the middle of a room and you looked at it from only one vantage point, you wouldn't see the whole sculpture. Mm-hmm. You need to work your way around the room and see all sides of it.
Now, at a certain point, you were, I don't know if you'd added or you were transferred over to family history.
So I came to church history in 1986. 10 years later, in 1996, I remained in my role in the church history department, and they added to my responsibilities the family history department. We were at a critical time in which we were moving from microfilm, which was an old and dying technology, into the tech world. I love tech, and I like to innovate. And so we gathered together, once again, a wonderful team of people, highly skilled technicians, highly skilled people from the tech field. We pulled them together, and we created a program called Family Search. Mm. It was a very difficult program at the time to pull together. Think about it for a minute. We're trying to put together the family tree of the entire human family. But we found very capable people who were willing to either come in as employees or volunteer their time, and that allowed us to produce a program which remains extraordinarily popular today.
Now, your last job before retirement, public affairs.
Yes.
That's got to be a change, going from history to public affairs.
It is a change, but what was interesting to me about it is that history, of course, flows out of the present moment. Mm. And in my role in public affairs, I was able to see history being created. I traveled around the world with church leaders and saw the church and its operations globally. That was very informative to me.
Just a couple of minutes left. You have a big new assignment, right? This is a big team effort, but you're going to be the principal writer on a new biography of Joseph Smith.
So I retired in March of 2020 at the height of the COVID pandemic. The day I retired, there was no retirement party. There was no chance to thank people. I simply walked into my office, cleared out all my books, and went home. And I thought that was the end. And then about a year later, I was called in by the first presidency of our church, and they commissioned me to write a biography of the church's founding prophet, Joseph Smith. And so characteristically, I've put together a team of people, a very good team. We were able to, you know, handpick the people that we wanted to assist on this. Many of the people working on this are from the Joseph Smith papers. These are people who spent a couple of decades themselves individually studying Joseph Smith and his life. Others are researchers in family history who are able to bring research skills that supplement what we've been able to produce through the Joseph Smith Papers Project. And in any case, we've pulled in together a large team of people across the country with a variety of skills, and we are on target to produce this in the schedule that I initially presented for this, which was basically a 10-year time period to complete the manuscript.
Well, so that'll still become. You're still working
on
that. Yes.
From a more personal perspective, having retired, some people say, well, what's your calling? What's your position? I say failed retiree. It's my official title.
Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people who retired, and they're busier than ever, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so that includes you. Well, we've been talking with Richard E. Turley, Jr. He's a former managing director of the Church History and Family History Departments of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's giving the Arrington Mormon History Lecture. It's called Team History, the Latter-day Saint Historical Enterprise, 1986 to 2025. That'll be this evening, 7 o'clock, Russell Wanless Performance Hall, USU Logan Campus, and everyone is invited. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.